see the toad. Waiting, wondering is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. Tonight, my guest is calling us all the way from Paris, France. Her name is Suzanne Meyer. She's a Reiki artist, or I should say a Reiki master. She's actually authored a brand new book, and it's called Becoming Human Again. I'm finding it quite intriguing, working my way through it. Suzanne, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Hello. I'm excited to be on the Shame Free Zone.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. I've been reading about your father, who it sounds like he had an amazing connection to the things that really matter in life. This one quote I pulled from your book, it's on page 7, and it really stuck out for me, and it says, with so many sales, bargains, special offers, and two-for-one deals out there, we can't resist. We behave like squirrels, piling up possessions, overeating, and elbowing our way up the ladder to compete with the world and God and fight against nature.
Yes, that's what
I think
do.
You have very...
Unfortunately, that's what we all do as we go through life, because we are essentially predictively programmed by corporations, by our government, to behave a certain way, and that's what they tell us to do, and that's what we do, because it's just too tempting to resist the latest offer in the store or whatever, a two-for-one deal, and it's what we do. And instead of spending time with ourselves and going within and going for a walk in nature or doing something that's good for us, we go and do something for the outside, as I call it, for the without, and add another piece of clothing to our closet or you name it. That's what we do.
And it's actually you also talk about the fact that we receive about 5,000 external stimuli per day, and that includes about 8 hours in front of a screen, whether that's a television or a computer monitor or a cell phone or a gaming console or whatever. So people are not really getting connected to each other or nature very much, it wouldn't seem. If you've got 8 hours in front of a screen and then another 8 hours probably working a job, doesn't leave a lot, huh? Suzanne? And we're just waiting to connect with Suzanne. As I mentioned, my guest is in Paris tonight, so we might be having a couple of difficulties with our communications, but hopefully we'll get her back on here to talk about her book, Becoming Human Again. The subtext actually is From Sheeple to People. So I guess the question tonight is, what is a sheeple? Suzanne, are you there?
Yes. Sorry, you lost me. I don't know what happened.
I don't know what happened either, but you're just in time to answer the question of the evening, which is, what is a sheeple?
Sheeple is what we are, actually, right now. And we humans are sheeple at this point. We're behaving like robots. We're behaving like androids, predictably programmed androids, and not people. And the point I make in my book, we got to move from sheeple, from being such a robot, from being somebody that's reacting instead of acting, to a person again, a human being, a being that has a personality, a being that knows himself, herself, knows the within, and then acts and does stuff mindfully, consciously, sustainably, and responsibly. And we don't do that right now in this world. We do quite the opposite. We react to things, we're very emotional, and we have no clue who we are inside. No clue. We've forgotten that over the last decade, and with all the external stimuli that we receive, as we previously talked about, it is getting worse and worse and worse. In fact, we're a puppet that's managed by puppeteers, and the puppeteers change. There's numerous. There's the government, as I mentioned, and there's corporations, and they rule our lives. And we don't ask questions because we're quite lazy, actually. We don't, because it's, you know, it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to get to know ourselves. So there's actually work involved. It's like learning to ride a bicycle or like drive a car. But once we get good at it, it's wonderful. You know, that should be, everyone's goal in life, is breaking down the last frontier, which is the human being, which is ourself, which is our within.
Well, now, you apparently lived in the United States, the United Kingdom, Switzerland, Canada, Sri Lanka, and Peru, but you've also traveled to over 70 countries. So do you think that this is this sheeple phenomena? Do you think it's peculiar to the United States or perhaps Europe, or have you found it to be a constant throughout the world?
I think the more money a country has, the more sheeple behavior you have. And when I was in Sri Lanka, you know, people are not bombarded with 5,000 stimuli per day yet. People still live with nature. They don't have as much money, obviously, we have. They live closer to animals, to the surroundings, and they have a community. They still talk to their neighbors. They still talk to other people on a daily basis. They don't sit in front of a screen. They're still out with greens. Greens instead of greens is one of the points I make. It's like they still have that. But the more money we have, the more we have to lose, and the more we put a fortress around ourselves and connect to other people via remote devices instead of directly in a community. And that's one thing that gets worse and worse and worse, the more money a country has. It just keeps isolating us.
You know, I had heard something that I thought was pretty depressing about India, you know, has a problem with overpopulation. And they were looking for ways to curb the birth rate. And they discovered that people who own television sets tend to watch late-night TV instead of having sex with their spouse. So it became a goal of the Indian government to put inexpensive televisions into the houses of all the poor people who didn't have TVs yet, so that they would be distracted by late-night TV and not have more children. And I'm all for curbing the birth rate. I think it's ridiculous how many human beings we're creating on this planet. The planet just simply can't sustain it. But the idea of alienating partners so that they're not having sex with each other so that we could stop the population explosion, to me, was just such a sad commentary on the way we deal with things, you know?
But it works, you know. People, you know, television is essentially, it's hypnotizing people. And if you put something in front of the television, they go into another world. There's actually studies on that, you know, a television, yeah, really hypnotizes, I believe it was the right side of your brain. And you don't know, as your brain doesn't know the difference between reality and TV. So that's the reason why, you know, also when we watch a thriller, we get nervous, you know, our heart starts beating, you know, or when we watch a love movie, then we cry or we get emotional or whatever. It really hypnotizes us. And what you said about the Indian people, you know, they love it. I mean, everyone loves it. It's a form of entertaining. It's a form of distracting. And yes, definitely, you probably won't never have sex again. Why should you? You know, it's what we all do. We come home from work, you know, we turn on the TV and we think it's actually, it chills us out, it relaxes us, but it doesn't. I mean, it stresses us out even more. It's just unconsciously, it's happening unconsciously, and it, we're not, you know, we don't realize what's being done to us, especially the news. I mean, my God, have you watched the news lately, especially, or it's been deteriorating over the past decade, the news. I mean, to me, it's like it's infotainment. They show us the world, but it's not what really goes on. It's really fairy tales. But we swallow it up, we believe it, and we become emotional and we act according to input. Just like, you know, with Japan. Okay, yes, we shouldn't have nuclear plants, you know. But everybody, like in Europe, they just had votes, you know, in several countries, and the Green parties have won, which is, you know, essentially probably not a bad thing. But we act according to emotion. Just, okay, something happens in the world, and oh, my God, you know, everybody listens to their emotions, goes to vote. But is that the solution? You know, we should, if we went within more and listen to our being, we actually understand the world on a whole different level, not just according to TV or according to emotions or whatnot. We would understand it from our own core, and that's important.
Now, you've studied Tantra and Buddhism. Tell our listeners a little bit about how those two disciplines have helped you to become more connected with yourself and with your intuition.
Well, it's a process. I mean, you know, I've been studying spirituality in numerous different disciplines for many years. And Tantra and Buddhism are just, you know, Buddhism is not a religion and neither is Tantra. It's like, it's a way of life. It's a way of not praying to a god or a deity or whatnot, as most people do. It's really to going within. And it's so fascinating about a country like India, for example, or Japan, for that matter, is you really have a different mindset. Like in India, people's goals, and they're taught that as a child, is to, you know, maybe become enlightened in your life. Like, wow, what a concept. Or with Tantra, also there, well, not all of India is called Tantra, but, you know, met some people who are quite advanced. It's like to fully enjoy being with your partner. Tantra is not just about sex, but it is using the sexual energy to get to the next level. And sexual energy is actually very, very good for that. It can transpose you into another dimension and actually give you instant enlightenment. And that's what part of Tantra is in India. Not necessarily what we practice here. Tantra, what we practice here is kind of, yeah, it's not really what goes on in India. It's not just, you know, the sexual positions and this and that. It's completely different. So it's all towards, you know, making you grow as a person, taking you as a person to the next level. And these people are tremendous. That's a tremendous aid for these people as growing for their personal growth in their life. On all topics, you know, it helps you at work, it helps you everywhere. It's like you grow as a person, you grow everywhere. You grow in your relationship, you grow at work, you grow as a consumer. And that's a good thing in India. And I always feel like when I go to India and I've been to a couple of ashrams, I've done a couple of Ayurvedic cleansings, you instantly feel that energy. You know, you get it. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. I think you have to experience for itself, but it's there. you know, and we need more of that here.
You kind of touched upon it, the difference between Tantra in the East and Tantra as it's practiced in the West, but can you give our listeners maybe a little more specifics about how they differ? Because I think what people in the West are thinking about Tantra, they probably are thinking mostly about sting and protracted orgasms, and, you know, it's all about the sex.
Yeah, and it's really not. I mean, Tantra has been around for, like, I don't know, 2,500 years. It's one of the oldest ways of life there actually is. There is a person, his name is Osho. I'm not sure you're familiar with it. He talks about it a lot, and I studied his teachings, and I find it really, really fascinating. Tantra in the West, as you said, is mostly about, you know, sexual positions, better orgasms, et cetera, et cetera. But the core of Tantra, it's about being, and I'm not the expert on Tantra. I'm just sharing you from what I think Tantra is. Tantra is about being with your partner. Tantra is about being with yourself. Tantra is about stillness, and as it translates to a couple, it's about using stillness, being together in stillness, and having sex more on, you know, with focus on being, with focus on feeling, with focus on exploring each other, which could take hours, actually, and maybe not having an orgasm at all. They call it the valley orgasm and the peak orgasm. So in the West, we have peak orgasm. You know, we have sex. We have sex fast. We want to go... we want to reach the peak, like, really fast, and then we crash down. In India, you have a valley orgasm, which is really, really, really slow. Like I said, may take hours. It is very fulfilling, and you may not have or want to have sex after that for months or weeks because you're so fulfilled from that experience. And that is something completely unknown to us in the West. You know, we just keep chasing after the latest and greatest orgasms because we're hooked on it. It gives us an instant high, just like shopping, just like all the other stuff that we do. And then we run to the next one. But are we really fulfilled? Not really. I mean, we're fulfilled for, you know, a couple minutes or maybe a couple hours afterwards. But the longer fulfillment, as taught by Tantra in the East, we don't have.
And this is actually one of the things you talk about is slowing down, stopping. Here's a quote: "Stop the punishing multitasking." and people are punishing themselves, I think, with a lot of multitasking. We're certainly come a far cry from being human beings. We are definitely all about being human doings. You know, we're just constantly do. We're in perpetual motion. But it's a hard thing to ask people to stop doing that. I think a lot of people feel pretty fearful that if they are not competing, that they will become irrelevant, and the things that they need to do in order just to survive or tread water won't get done. So, do you have any answers for those fears? Those fears that people have?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you see your desk neighbor blackberrying 24/7 or multitasking 24/7. You think you have to do the same thing. But my question always is, are these people effective? Are they efficient? I doubt it. Because most people are not, they cannot multitask, especially men. But they cannot multitask. A computer can multitask, but we can't. So you do essentially 2, 3, or 4, 5 things badly instead of one thing really great. So I question how effective these people are, because when you do things from the core, when you do one thing at a time and you're fully focused on it, you know, in the present moment, the power of now, then you're doing it well. But, you know, as we work, we are constantly multitasking. We are constantly answering an email. We're writing a business plan. We're answering a text message. We are not focused anymore at all. And I see, I mean, I work in the corporate world, and I see quality being delivered from, you know, let's assume intelligent people. That is awful, you know. And I saw the degradation over the past decades. It keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And we also accept worse and worse and worse quality as passable. May this be in school or may it be at work, it is deteriorating. We used to take pride in delivering a document without an error.
Oh, unfortunately, I think we've lost Suzanne again. So we need to get her back on the air here. Seth, are you there? And once again, we lost contact with Paris, so bear with us in a minute. Suzanne will be back with us, I'm sure. Once again, the name of her book, Becoming Human Again, and her name is Suzanne Meyer. It's a brand new book, and her premise is that human beings have become sheeple, meaning that people are very much acting like sheep nowadays.
She's with us again.
Suzanne, are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry. You know, I don't know what's happening in Paris with these phone lines.
Oh, well, you know, it's okay. You know, I noticed in your book that one of the things you admonish people to do is raise humans, not monsters. And first of all, of course, it begs the question, do you have children?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, fancy talk.
Yeah, it's easy to talk, I know. It's easy to talk. But it's just, you know, my book is observations. You know, I observe society. I observe what's happened over the past decades. And as I previously mentioned, the degradation of it. And I watch what's going on with children, with parents. They're raising children with the rights that people, I mean, children nowadays have, and what's happening in schools. My sister's a teacher, and I, you know, she tells me stories like you wouldn't believe. I mean, children are children. They're the, you know, the beginning of life. They need to have guidance from parents, from schools, from grandparents, you name it. And I just see that they're given rights. They're allowed to make decisions, and at an age that is way too early, you can't make a decision at 4, 5, 6 years old. There's a time and a place for all of that, and it's happening just way too early. And what you're creating is monsters. And you know, go to any shop, go to any mall in the States, and you see scenes that are unbelievable. It's just children are shopping, children are picking items, placing it in the shopping cart, or you name it. It's just that we've created these monsters. And I don't think that that's really a good thing for society, because who's going to essentially teach these children the word no? Because no is totally out for children. I mean, no is something they never hear, maybe until they end up in the workplace, because a teacher is essentially crippled. A teacher has to behave in a very politically correct way nowadays. They're not allowed to, you know, discipline children anymore as they used to. I mean, I'm not talking about beating them up, but I'm just talking about a little discipline. A little discipline has never hurt people, not at any age. So, and then you have the parents that don't say no. So you have all that continuing into, you know, maybe till they go to work. And it's not something that, you know, that's going to be beneficial for society. You know, we can't have all these entitled people walking around, because there's, you know, if there's so much, with so much entitlement comes a lot of ego, and that creates way too many problems that we don't need.
Well, I noticed that one of the things your book seems to talk about quite consistently is the connection to nature. and you mentioned that in respect to raising children, to encourage them to be connected to nature. That can be a bit of a difficult thing for some people who are living in urban areas. There's some children that have never really even stepped on soil. You know, their whole life has been on blacktop or concrete. How would you recommend people who are living in urban areas enable their children to connect with nature?
Yeah, I mean, there's cities like Tokyo, I would say, is a good example where it's probably a bit challenging to connect to nature, but it's always possible. I mean, we have parks, we have animals, we have ponds with ducks in them. I mean, there's always ways, and in most cities, you know, in the U.S., it's not that expensive to get out of the city, to get into nature. I mean, you know, instead of going on a shopping stint on a Sunday afternoon, you may as well take your, you know, children and drive them out to nature and, you know, explain them nature and, you know, go for a walk in the woods. I mean, I think it's possible in most cities, or take them to the zoo, or if that's really not possible, then meditate with your children. I mean, if in a place like Tokyo, meditation is actually with children is very, very common. You know, you see people in parks doing Tai Chi, Qigong, or simply meditating. And somebody once told me, actually one of the teachers at the Monroe Institute, I'm not sure you're familiar with that in Virginia, she told me that in Japan they use meditation because they have a lack of nature in Tokyo. So people would go and they go without, they go into the other world because it's not really possible for them to, you know, expose themselves to too much nature. So they go into the other world, which is another solution. And it seems to work.
Absolutely. So that's quite beautiful. And you certainly don't see adults meditating with children in the United States.
No, you don't. But that's what we need to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we can have meditation breaks at school.
That would be something.
That would be something.
I think that would be a solution. I mean, instead of making your own schedule for school, which children are doing nowadays, you know, meditate on it. get your classes from the universe.
You also talk about the dangers of allowing fast food joints like McDonald's to kind of program our children to believe that junk food is a treat, especially, you know, if you get a Happy Meal and you get a toy with it. I've had stepchildren co-parenting with other parents. It can be a real challenge when it comes to food issues because they eat what they want to eat when they're in the other home. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the McDonald's thing is a good example. It speaks, you know, as children were very gullible, and if our brain receives an input, oh, this is a reward. I mean, people usually take their children, or a lot of people take their children to McDonald's as a reward, or for their birthday. Hopefully not every day, but, you know, and so it gets programmed into their brain, oh, this is a good thing, you know, McDonald's is a reward for me. So as an adult, then fast food is a reward for you. So when you've done something good, you get a special treat. You reward yourself with McDonald's or with any other type of fast food. And that's pretty hard to get rid of. You know, once it's there, something that you learn as a child is very powerful. It affects you your whole life, and to get rid of it is really hard. So you have to retrain your brain then, you know. Oh, raw food. I should use raw food as a reward, but, you know, that doesn't fly really well. But it's just bad because, you know, all this stuff contributes to obesity, of course, and has a lot to do with mindset and has a lot to do with thinking about food. In France, for example, children are taught at a very early age, in school, how to eat, what is healthy, what foods you should focus on, what foods you should eat most, and where they come from. And that's really important. Where do foods come from? We completely forgot about that. I mean, we have children in the States that don't even know chicken McNuggets come from an animal. You know, and it's really important to realize where it's coming from and how it's processed. Because you don't want to know all that goes on in the food processing world, because otherwise you wouldn't eat anything anymore. But you have to be mindful about it, and you have to think about it before you go out and buy something and consume it. And that's what I'm getting at in my book. It's like the whole thing, the whole system. Think about it. Go within yourself and ask yourself, is that really good for me? Is that double cheeseburger really what I need in my system? How was that produced? How much suffering is in that cheeseburger? You know, where does this come from? This used to be a cow walking around, and well, actually, not walking around, sitting in some stall for like a year or two before it got slaughtered. These type of things we have to be more conscious of, and then we will act different. But we have to know about it and learn about it.
The connection that you talk about, you know, we definitely, in the current culture, connection seems to be something that the awareness of that seems to be discouraged, actively discouraged, so that we don't know where our food's coming from, and we don't know how the animals are being treated, and we don't know where, you know. It's amazing to me how many people have no idea if something grows in the ground or in a tree, even.
You know, yeah.
They have no concept of it. But I know that one of the things that was really frustrating for me, and a lot of people are co-parenting. They're up against the challenge of children of divorce, which sometimes means that you don't get absolute control over the environment. And it can be quite a challenge when you're raising children to try to get them to move away from the video games and towards nature, or away from the fast food and towards something that's healthy. I think, you know, the culture becomes kind of like a shiny toy. You know, that it's really hard to get people to put that down and then go find something with more substance. Do you have any recommendations about not only how people might be able to convince their children to adjust their interests, but also just how adults can do it? Because, people, like you said, it's the word you coined, sheeple, right? They tend to want to follow the other sheep. So how do you break out of that?
Yes, definitely. But that's why I believe it's crucial to realize, to know what is going on. And in my book, I tried to point out the areas in life where we are truly sheeple, you know, where we behave as a follower always, or predictively programmed robot instead of a human. And I think it's essential that people realize what's going on, because I think most people, they don't know. They just get up in the morning, you know, they do what they need to do, go to work, you know, consume this, eat this, but they never really think about life or being or the within or whatnot. So if you tell these people really what's going on, you know, reality that we have out there, which is not reality, which is a make-believe world essentially, then I could motivate them to take a different approach, to think about life differently. Because once you see that light, and once you realize how manipulated we are, because we are greatly manipulated, then I believe we can trigger change. But you have to know first. You have to get to the realization first, and then you can act. And the acting is waking up, you know, I mean, waking up happens in numerous different ways. But then awakening the within, and that can, as I previously said, you know, that's like learning to ride a bicycle. You have to pick a discipline, you know, may that be Tantra, may that be Buddhism, may it be Zen, may it be just, you know, reading the power of now and practicing to be in the present moment. May that be Ho'oponopono, may that be yoga or Qigong. One of the disciplines that gives you stillness, gives you a peace, gives you meditation. And then you can grow from there. And I really think it's the only way. It's knowing yourself, connecting to yourself, then will also connect you to earth. It will connect you to nature. And you will be able to act from your core, not from without. You will be able to trust yourself again, because most people don't trust themselves because they don't know themselves.
So I think it's important to help people understand why they don't want to be like the other sheep, don't you?
Because they're too lazy.
Well, that's a judgment.
Work.
But I mean,
you know,
I think to help people understand
to look at your life and realize what's going on. That's not pretty in a lot of ways. I mean, it's awful.
There has to be some kind of motivation.
You know, if I go out and buy that BMW and I have that wonderful job at Company X, I've succeeded. But have you? And that's why, you know, you have this midlife crisis. We have numerous midlife crisis victims in our life, right? You come to a point where you realize this is not giving you happiness. In fact, it's doing quite the opposite. It's stimulating your ego, but it's not stimulating your inner self, your happiness, your contentment. No, it's not doing all of that, because happiness, the way we experience happiness in our life, I mean in our world, is it's temporary happiness. Somebody makes you happy, or you have some external stimuli that gives you temporary happiness. You buy new shoes, you buy a new book, you buy this.
And I think we have once again dropped off our call to Paris. Well, it's been very exciting and interesting trying to maintain a conversation with Paris here. So I'm sure we'll try it one more time here. We've got about 20 minutes left to the shame-free zone. Seth, are you there? Okay.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
This French phone seem to have a 15-minute life, and then they die.
it seems so. Yes. Well, I'll tell you what. We've got about 20 minutes left of the program, so hopefully we'll get another 15 with you, and then
hopefully.
And I usually use the last 5 minutes to wrap up my program anyway, so
okay. So
no worries. You know, one of the things, I think at some point you were not able to hear me, and I, you know, people a lot of times, I think they feel very disillusioned and discouraged, and they may think they're fat, and they may think they're lazy, and it becomes very difficult for them to break out of those patterns, because I think a lot of people don't understand what is in it for them. Where's the reward? Why would they want to stop doing what everybody else is doing? And I wonder if you have an answer for that.
The reward is really tremendous. I mean, the reward of knowing yourself and understanding how big you are, how much of a consciousness we have is tremendous. It will give you inner peace. You will not have to rely on the latest blonic juice to give you that 5 minutes of happiness. You can actually rely on yourself, and you can act from within instead of, you know, being driven by the outside world. And also, you know, that's one of the benefits. Stillness, happiness, peace, but then you can take it to a whole other level. I can only speak for myself and for my own personal path. I mean, I started with Buddhism, Tantra, you name it, but I had an experience, I had a spiritual experience that has taken me to the next level. It's catapulted me to the next level. There is so much to explore. There's courses you can take, you know, in numerous institutes in the USA and Japan that will teach you how to, for example, go on an astral travel, have an out-of-body experience.